Državni ispitni center.
Maturità generale 2013.
Prova d'ascolto.
A tutti voi un cordiale saluto. Siamo all'inizio della prova d'ascolto d'inglese.
Questa prova d'esame si compone di due parti, la parte A e la parte B. Per ciascuna parte ascolterete un testo e risponderete poi a un esercizio che a esso si ricollega. Dapprima leggerete l'esercizio, poi ascolterete ciascun testo per due volte e risolverete l'esercizio durante l'ascolto. L'inizio e la fine del testo saranno indicati dal seguente segnale acustico.
Scrivete le vostre risposte negli spazi appositamente previsti all'interno della prova, utilizzando la penna stilografica o la penna a sfera. Scrivete in modo leggibile e ortograficamente corretto. In caso di errore, tracciate un segno sulla risposta scorretta e scrivete accanto ad essa quella corretta. Alle risposte e alle correzioni scritte in modo illeggibile verranno assegnati 0 punti.
Abbiate fiducia in voi stessi e nelle vostre capacità. Vi auguriamo buon lavoro.
Ascoltate con attenzione. Aprite la prova d'esame.
Section A. You will hear an interview with two contemporary writers about their novels. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
Novelist Julie Oringer and Alex Miller found themselves writing just such a book each, on opposite sides of the globe. Julie is a New Yorker whose novel The Invisible Bridge follows the story of Andras, a Hungarian Jew who moves to Paris in 1937 to study architecture. Alex Miller is Australian, and his book Love Song tells the tale of Sabiha and John, a Tunisian and an Aussie, who fall in love in a cafe in a rundown suburb far from the chic boulevards of downtown Paris. So what's the allure of writing about this city from its margins? Well, Alex Miller is here with me in the studio now, and Julie Oringer joins us from our studio in New York. Paris is hardly underserved in literature, so what tempted you both to use it as the setting for your respective novels? Alex, perhaps I can start with you.
Writing this book for me was a decision to write a book just simply for my own pleasure. I just drew on my own that landscape of memory and imagination for the location. Where had this man been? I thought, OK, so he went to Paris the way I did in the 70s, and I lived there for a year. And as a stranger, I wasn't going to go to cafes and restaurants where the French were, where the Parisians were. I was going to go to cafes and restaurants that where the outsiders were, people like myself, the émigrés. The first day I was there, I remember looking for somewhere to have dinner, and on the corner of my street, there was a little cafe with a big fat man behind the counter, and there were a whole bunch of women in the corner, and they were all laughing and pointing, and I thought, I'm going in there. That place is really laid back, it's relaxed, it's where strangers can go and meet. So when I came to write the book, this love story, I thought, that's where he's been. He's been out there in Vaugirard, which was then, in those days, it was a pretty smelly suburb.
Julie, how about you?
Well, in my case, it was my grandfather's experiences in Paris from 1937 to 1939. He, in fact, went to architecture school there. And when he told me his story, I found it so fascinating that it seemed necessary to put that material into a novel. And, of course, the historical period was so fascinating, too. So his real story landed me in Paris originally. Then, of course, I had the pleasure of moving out of the confines of the facts of the story into the fiction and different ways that I sort of fell in love with the city and began to imagine how a young man might fall in love both with the city and with one of its inhabitants there.
Julie, some of your novel is set in the Marais, once the traditional Jewish quarter, now a sort of trendy gay area.
Right.
How hard was it to evoke the atmosphere of this now near non-existent world? Because it's changed very dramatically in the period of time between where your novel's set and now.
Well, it required, I guess, an act of literary back extrapolation. Even now, when you walk around the Marais, in between the fancy boutiques and the gelato shops and the organic cafes, there are still tucked away some really wonderful little kosher butcher shops and Judaica shops, and enough of the old Marais to just give you a sense, a flavor, a hint of what it might have been like when it really was the Jewish quarter. But in a way, I feel like there's a sense of freedom that's conferred by the need to make things up a little bit and to render what something may have been like as opposed to creating a sense of exactly what it is like right now. I think that's one of the pleasures of fiction for me in any case.
Now you will hear the recording again.
Novelist Julie Oringer and Alex Miller found themselves writing just such a book each on opposite sides of the globe. Julie is a New Yorker whose novel The Invisible Bridge follows the story of Andras, a Hungarian Jew who moves to Paris in 1937 to study architecture. Alex Miller is Australian, and his book Love Song tells the tale of Sabiha and John, a Tunisian and an Aussie, who fall in love in a cafe in a rundown suburb far from the chic boulevards of downtown Paris. So what's the allure of writing about this city from its margins? Well, Alex Miller is here with me in the studio now, and Julie Oringer joins us from our studio in New York. Paris is hardly underserved in literature, so what tempted you both to use it as the setting for your respective novels? Alex, perhaps I can start with you.
Writing this book for me was a decision to write a book just simply for my own pleasure. I just drew on my own that landscape of memory and imagination for the location. Where had this man been? I thought, OK, so he went to Paris the way I did in the 70s, and I lived there for a year. And as a stranger, I wasn't going to go to cafes and restaurants where the French were, where the Parisians were. I was going to go to cafes and restaurants that where the outsiders were, people like myself, the émigrés. The first day I was there, I remember looking for somewhere to have dinner. And on the corner of my street, there was a little cafe with a big fat man behind the counter, and there were a whole bunch of women in the corner, and they were all laughing and pointing, and I thought, I'm going in there. That place is really laid back, it's relaxed, it's where strangers can go and meet. So when I came to write the book, this love story, I thought, that's where he's been. He's been out there in Vaugirard, which was then, in those days, it was a pretty smelly suburb.
Julie, how about you?
Well, in my case, it was my grandfather's experiences in Paris from 1937 to 1939. He, in fact, went to architecture school there. And when he told me his story, I found it so fascinating that it seemed necessary to put that material into a novel. And, of course, the historical period was so fascinating, too. So his real story landed me in Paris originally. Then, of course, I had the pleasure of moving out of the confines of the facts of the story into the fiction and different ways that I sort of fell in love with the city and began to imagine how a young man might fall in love both with the city and with one of its inhabitants there.
Julie, some of your novel is set in the Marais, once the traditional Jewish quarter, now a sort of trendy gay area.
Right.
How hard was it to evoke the atmosphere of this now near non-existent world? Because it's changed very dramatically in the period of time between where your novel's set and now.
Well, it required, I guess, an act of literary back extrapolation. Even now, when you walk around the Marais, in between the fancy boutiques and the gelato shops and the organic cafes, there are still tucked away some really wonderful little kosher butcher shops and Judaica shops, and enough of the old Marais to just give you a sense, a flavor, a hint of what it might have been like when it really was the Jewish quarter. But in a way, I feel like there's a sense of freedom that's conferred by the need to make things up a little bit and to render what something may have been like as opposed to creating a sense of exactly what it is like right now. I think that's one of the pleasures of fiction for me in any case.
This is the end of Section A. Section B. You will hear an interview with Tony Fitzjohn. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
Now, Tony Fitzjohn was so bored as a child that he used to bunk off school and go shoplifting. He didn't actually want or need the things he stole. He was just looking for a bit of excitement and an escape from his safe but dreary life in the suburbs of North London. This yearning for adventure was made even stronger by a tattered volume he found at the back of his parents' bookshelf. After reading Tarzan of the Apes under the bedclothes as he was recovering from typhus, Tony was determined to go to Africa. He set off for South Africa with an auntie. Soon after that, he went to Kenya, where he worked as an apprentice to George Adamson, made famous by the book and film Born Free. Tony has devoted 40 years to reintroducing lions, leopards and rhinos to the wild. These days he's based in Tanzania, where he created a new national park. On a rare visit to London, he came into the Outlook studio, and he began by telling me how he'd developed such a special relationship with lions.
The animals have to like you first. If they think there's something wonky with us and they don't like us, you know, they're probably not going to change their minds. And our relationship was based on the fact that we treated them with a lot of respect, a lot of understanding and obviously a lot of love, and they responded with their trust and their affection. It was a completely equal relationship. When they were younger and getting into trouble with wild lion or other animals, they need our help. And as they got older, they had to cope on their own. But they still maintain that relationship. Do you have to have something, or is it just the fact that animals certainly... they certainly know if you're sympathetic towards them, and I think that's probably enough, you know. It's just love.
So what was it like, your first close encounter with the lion?
Well, I'd arrived one night. Next day, I followed George down to the river, who was walking a lioness down. And I followed him down the road, and we got to the river about an hour and a half later, and we found Christian and another lioness called Juma. George, all very proud, said, "Well, Tony, I think you better, you know, come and say hello to Christian." You know, like someone was introducing their son or their tortoise or something. So I got out of the car, and Christian immediately crouched and looked at me with those huge feline eyes, with his tail flicking in this sign of indecision. And George looked, George said, "Well, he's a bit frisky today. I think you better get back in the car." And I thought, well, so much for that. You know, I mean, this is great. You know, this was... I realised that night I arrived there that this is it. This was everything that had been bubbling in my head for years. And so the next day we go down and do the same thing, and Christian did the same thing again. And I just looked at George and I thought, you know, whatever he's got there, I want some of that. That's exactly what I want. And if he can do it, I can do it. So I got out of the car. I walked up to straight up to Christian, right up to his nose, and I said, "Hi, Christian, I'm Fitz." And he just looked at me as if he was about to spring, and then stood up and stretched like he wasn't playing around at all, and gave me a big head rub, and we wandered off down the river together. You know?
A head rub?
Or... yeah, but they use their heads for greeting.
Right. Well, I think my cat does that sometimes.
Yeah, they're cats.
Now you will hear the recording again.
Now, Tony Fitzjohn was so bored as a child that he used to bunk off school and go shoplifting. He didn't actually want or need the things he stole. He was just looking for a bit of excitement and an escape from his safe but dreary life in the suburbs of North London. This yearning for adventure was made even stronger by a tattered volume he found at the back of his parents' bookshelf. After reading Tarzan of the Apes under the bedclothes as he was recovering from typhus, Tony was determined to go to Africa. he set off for South Africa with an auntie. Soon after that, he went to Kenya, where he worked as an apprentice to George Adamson, made famous by the book and film Born Free. Tony has devoted 40 years to reintroducing lions, leopards and rhinos to the wild. These days he's based in Tanzania, where he created a new national park. On a rare visit to London, he came into the Outlook studio, and he began by telling me how he'd developed such a special relationship with lions.
The animals have to like you first. If they think there's something wonky with us, and they don't like us, you know, they're probably not going to change their minds. And our relationship was based on the fact that we treated them with a lot of respect, a lot of understanding, and obviously a lot of love, and they responded with their trust and their affection. It was a completely equal relationship. When they were younger and getting into trouble with wild lion or other animals, they'd need our help. And as they got older, they had to cope on their own. But they still maintain that relationship. Do you have to have something, or is it just the fact that animals certainly... they certainly know if you're sympathetic towards them, and I think that's probably enough, you know. It's just love.
So what was it like, your first close encounter with the lion?
Well, I'd arrived one night. Next day, I followed George down to the river, who was walking a lioness down. And I followed him down the road, and we got to the river about an hour and a half later, and we found Christian and another lioness called Juma. George, all very proud, said, "Well, Tony, I think you better, you know, come and say hello to Christian." You know, like someone was introducing their son or their tortoise or something. So I got out of the car, and Christian immediately crouched and looked at me with those huge feline eyes, with his tail flicking in this sign of indecision. And George said, "He's a bit frisky today. I think you better get back in the car." And I thought, well, so much for that. You know, I mean, this is great. You know, this was... I realised that night I arrived there that this is it. This was everything that had been bubbling in my head for years. And so the next day we go down and do the same thing, and Christian did the same thing again. And I just looked at George and I thought, you know, whatever he's got there, I want some of that. That's exactly what I want. And if he can do it, I can do it. So I got out of the car. I walked up to straight up to Christian, right up to his nose, and I said, "Hi, Christian, I'm Fitz." And he just looked at me as if he was about to spring, and then stood up and stretched like he wasn't playing around at all, and gave me a big head rub, and we wandered off down the river together. You know?
A head rub?
Or... yeah, but they use their heads for greeting.
Right. Well, I think my cat does that sometimes.
Yeah, they're cats.
This is the end of section B.
Siamo alla conclusione della prova d'ascolto d'inglese. Smettete di scrivere, chiudete la prova d'esame e posatela sull'orlo del banco insieme alla scheda di valutazione.
Ancora un cordiale saluto.